welcome to Healthy Brain, Happy Body, a podcast from the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society. I'm Dr. Saul Rosenthal, a health psychologist in the Boston area, and your host as we investigate the incredible connections between brain and body. Welcome, everyone, back to Healthy Brain, Happy Body. And today we are diving into concussion management, specifically how to make clinical decisions when the data are not always clear, which is frequently the case with concussion. So my guest today is David Imes. He's a neurofeedback provider with a background in neurophysiology and concussion care. And he just gave a webinar for the NRBS about the excellent brain system for symptom tracking and management. And we're going to talk about concussion care and whether tools like the Excellent Brain can improve our care. David, welcome. Glad you're here.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So you've spent a lot of time in concussion work. Where do we kind of get it wrong?
That's a good question. Every concussion is so unique. And, you know, my mentor would say, if you've seen one concussion, you've seen one concussion, that one concussion. I think it's very important to meet the individual where they are at. And then perhaps it's even just validating the nature of what we're even talking about and the fact that it's even occurred and what it can influence. Because even just thinking in like clinical experiences, whether it's a case of somebody coming through for concussion or not, especially those not, there's perhaps that concussion injury or something like it lurking in the background that people are overlooking, not realizing the effects that it's even maybe had on their life. And so I think, you know, in terms of what's not happening or what are we doing wrong, you know, maybe it's just even acknowledging the literal force of nature that it even is in the first place and how far it can ripple through an individual's life and how that impacts, you know, social functioning, academic or school functioning. You know, like, it's interesting to ask somebody, you know, when did things change? When did this issue start, whenever it is? And then they start to say, well, it was around, you know, maybe let's say something oddly specific. You know, it was August, you know, whatever, 2017. And you're like, oh, okay, well, why then? And they're like, well, that's just kind of when it started. You know, I was like, well, what happened around that time? And they'll be like, oh, nothing really. I don't know. It's just busy time. Like, well, were there any big life events or anything like that? And they're like, well, I don't know, not really. I mean, I was starting, I don't know, a semester at college or high school or whatever. And then you ask the question, you know, any head injuries or, you know, any concussions or anything like that? And it's very common that you hear no, nothing. And then you ask a little bit more, you know, anything, or what about around that time? Anything there, you know, and then it's, well, you know, I did have that one hard knock when I was playing pickup soccer. When was that? July. And it's, you know, and so there it is. So I think we overlook it accidentally. And it hides in plain sight because we're not walking around with a bandage on our head most of the time. It's, you know, it's that sprain, that brain sprain. So I think overlooking it in the first place is one thing that gets missed, unfortunately.
Yeah, and that's almost an issue with us as clinicians, but also with the patients, like you're saying. They'll often deny and honestly deny that there was any concussion or head hit because so frequently it's never diagnosed. They don't go in. If they have symptoms, they often resolve within a couple of days. Mm-hmm. So it seems like it's sort of partly a knowledge deficit, if you will. But also to some extent, I wonder how much of it is sort of the system in which we're trying to gather data.
Yeah.
So is it sort of both, and what kinds of things, you know, what works at the clinic you're at? I mean, again, you've been doing this for a long time. So what yeah. makes it more likely we're going to be able to get the valid data?
Yeah. I agree with the direction you're heading. It's a both and situation, you know, that the awareness element, whether it's, you know, the person or the clinician And yeah, a lot of times it is resolving, at least as we think. And yet maybe it's having some lingering effects that we don't fully recognize. I think that in terms of the assessment and the validation piece, and this is another element where it could be done better, is some sort of baseline testing. That's not happening. It typically, whether it's, you know, through something like Excellent Brain, which is that concussion management platform, which is offering a symptom checklist that lets you monitor symptoms. But if that's done at a baseline, you have somebody, let's say preseason, rating their symptoms across the different domains, you know, things like migraine type symptoms, cognitive, mood, worry, vestibular, sleep, anger. And so if we can establish a baseline of how somebody is typically feeling, should it deviate from that after something like an injury, we now have a comparison point. And same with the cognitive testing, even more importantly, perhaps, because that's getting more objective, you know, taking this cognitive test as a baseline measure, very important, you know, it. And so one thing we could be doing better is some form of baseline testing through both those assessment measures, subjective or objective, but then also, you know, I leaned heavily on the EEG, QEG element, and correlating that. I mean, I would love all of this to be part of the routine physical assessment that somebody has to go through preseason. You know, typically you're having to go through a appointment with the pediatrician or the primary care. I wish that brain health was more considered in that conversation, especially preseason. So then even in the QEG or EEG, QEG element, to have a baseline there would be extremely powerful. Not only would you have that as a way to compare after injury, but you would also have that as a way of cross-correlating with the cognitive measures on something like Excellent Brain's test, to look at, you know, how do those line up? And then how do they change after injury? So incorporating brain assessment, brain health, directly and indirectly. And I'll say, you know, directly as in assessing the brain itself using brain activity as one of the measurement tools, but then also indirectly, because, you know, there's a computerized test, that sort of thing. If, you know, I like a lot of metaphors, analogies, you know, so it's kind of like looking at the EEG, let's seeing how does the car perform, you know, once you actually, you know, take it out, let's say, and hear how it runs. See how it drives. You know, does it sound right? But then when you actually put it on put somebody on a test, you're now putting that brain, if you will, on a track or actually out on the road and really seeing how it does perform. And you need both, but looking at them both and being able to assess both, I think is really important.
That actually, we're primarily talking about athletes here. And so, because they're at a high risk, or in the population probably higher than most others. And I know around here in the Boston area, a lot of the schools do pre-testing of their athletes with a relatively, you know, quick and dirty concussion measure. But a lot don't. A lot of schools and don't. Don't do that. But you actually raise an interesting question about, if we want to push that metaphor further, the car driving metaphor. So something like the Excellent Brain system provides that baseline. Is that right? You can get the baseline out of that.
Yeah, it lets you like, ideally, a whole school system or some sort of level of organization gets into it, and then the athletes take it before the season starts.
Okay. And then how do you do that sort of pressure testing, if you will, the testing under load? Is that post-injury? Is it you just sort of do it along the way during the season? How does that work?
Sure. So even tying back towards your earlier question and kind of how do we do it in the clinic, it was then after injury. So the pressure testing would be you have the individual who has hopefully done the baseline, but even if they hadn't done the baseline in preseason, after injury, they do that same computer test. And at that point, you've now done the pressure testing. You're now getting these measures of verbal memory, nonverbal memory, verbal processing, nonverbal processing, attention and emotional reactivity. And the emotional reactivity is really looking at correctly or accurately identifying the emotional state of pictures on the screen. And it cycles through different emotional states and you're trying to correctly identify them. But anyway, so the pressure testing is yes, after the injury. And then you're seeing, you know, how's the car driving mm-hmm. on the track after it's been, you know, let's say run into.
And what sorts of advantages does the Excellent Brain system have for managing or for at least following these symptoms?
The symptoms itself, through this symptom checklist tool, it lets you, or it lets, let's say the athlete, the individual, rank certain symptoms on a Likert scale, more or less saying, is a symptom happening sometimes, often, very often, maybe it's never, and it puts a statement to them. So it's like, I've been having headaches, you know, and it's trying to ask them for the last 24 hours. And so that symptom tracker is only a matter of minutes to complete. And so you can have somebody do this every day after injury, let's say. And so after the injury, let's say the day after the injury, you have this symptom checklist and you get a score that's high, maybe it's 40. And then over the course of recovery, let's say, even if they just do that every 5 days, ideally, right, and what you would expect is that as they recover, that symptom score gradually reduces. And so as they are improving, they are noticing fewer and fewer of those concussion-related symptoms. And those concussion-related symptoms are reflecting that functional disturbance of the underlying neurophysiology that's been disturbed as, you know, as a result of that physical, you know, trauma. It's, you know, the physics of it. And so you've got Excellent Brain's platform through symptom checklists that's now letting you not only measure that as change over time, but then it's nice when you see it on a graph, and then it even helps drive conversation with somebody as they even measure their own self in terms of recovery, because it's maybe hard for that person to remember, you know, how did I feel 3 Mondays ago, you know, especially, and that's anybody, but then, you know, let's add in a concussion and yeah, our memory is disturbed and our mental clarity is disturbed. And so along with that, you're getting that change over time. The cognitive scores, those are also affected, you know, again, functional disturbance as related to the physical injury. The memory score, you know, let's say it's at whatever score, hopefully good, at baseline. After injury, let's say the brain moves around inside the skull, and then it bumps the inside of the skull near the temporal regions. And now we're seeing disturbances in memory. And then also it's the frontal lobe is in hitting the inside of the skull near the frontal region, disturbing working memory. You know, two different versions of memory. And we can see changes with that over time, so that as the person is recovering, hopefully that cognitive type or that those cognitive measures on the computer test, while they are probably lower after injury, they gradually increase and improve through recovery. So we're now getting measurements of both symptom as well as cognitive performance through the recovery process.
So can help track that recovery process. I guess I was also curious about whether it might inform intervention. So are there any, is there research or anything showing connections between Excellent Brain scores and sort of optimal intervention?
For one, the most typically recommended intervention is rest. And so through rest, ideally you see those scores improve. It's hard to rest a lot of the time, especially in today's times.
Yes.
And so it's very challenging to motivate someone to perhaps remember, hey, you are, your brain is sprained. There's a reason you're feeling this way. You're not just making this up. And so then validating the rest, let's say as they are following the relative rest and return to play protocols, that they are on the right track, showing, hey, look, your symptoms are reducing. Now, there are other things that could be, you know, woven into that. I've had a lot of experience using neurofeedback, you know, and different types of neurotherapy in this sphere as well. And it can be a way to, let's say, with neurofeedback, guide the process and reinforce optimal brain functioning through that brain training that is neurofeedback. And so with that, you can see improvements to the symptoms as well as the cognitive score. And yet, to, let's say, challenge my own statement, ideally, there is with recovery improvements as well. So it can be difficult to say how much is improvement in symptom or cognitive functioning through recovery alone, and how much is it through the neurofeedback plus that recovery on its own. I would say that with the neurofeedback in play, you're seeing a guided recovery that's being supported versus somebody who's recovering on their own. Yes, they will get better. And yet sometimes those chronic concussion symptoms do linger. And then we're talking about something different, which is less acute concussion, more a chronic post-concussive syndrome.
So you'd also talked about integrating EEG and QEEG into this process. How are you doing that? What does that give us that the Excellent Brain system or similar systems don't give us by themselves?
Sure. For one, it's even just the QEEG in general, I think, across and beyond concussion, but just fundamentally, you know, I think it ends up being very validating. And so without a baseline, there is the caveat of, you know, saying to somebody, look, let's say if you had a baseline in hand, you could say, here's your brain function as measured by QEEG preseason, and here is your QEEG after injury. Look at these differences, you know, all other things aside, we see these changes, and these changes make sense with the concussion. But without that in the mix, to even just have somebody come in and do a QEEG after injury, you're now looking at typically increases in lower arousal brainwave patterns in the typically delta and theta frequency ranges. And those are typically increasing. And in my experience, they're often increasing in areas that correlate with the performance on the cognitive score. So for example, poor, let's say verbal scores, typically increases in the slow wave activities in the left hemisphere, because just painting with a broad brush, the left hemisphere is often considered to be that verbal, both expressing as well as processing hemisphere. And so then there you are, quite literally visualizing through the QEG data, hey, look, there are these increased slow wave patterns that suggest lower arousal, and they are in areas that correlate heavily with the very functional disturbances that we see mapped on the cognitive testing. So you're really validating, because it is very common for people to be even wondering, am I actually in, like, is this real? Is this actually happening? Even the emotional ability symptoms, that's not exactly measured in something like a cognitive test. Sure, the emotion identification component is relevant, you know, but that's more of a nonverbal facial recognition task. You know, are we identifying the facial features and nonverbal expressions that suggest happiness versus sadness versus anger? I'm talking about just, you know, somebody's ability to regulate their own emotions, which is often impacted by the impact that is a concussion. And sometimes people will say things to the effect of, I feel like I'm crazy, because they are suddenly short-tempered, short-fused, you know, crying over what they feel like is nothing, enraged over what they feel like is not much, or at least, you know, that disproportionate emotional response. And yet, there you are with the QEG data in hand saying, okay, well, yes, you feel that way. Yes, you are having these emotional responses. You know, in the jargon, it's emotional ability, let's say. And yet, the brain function through QEG is suggesting a dysregulation in those temporal lobes or in the frontal lobes, and, you know, in various regions that are influencing that very, you know, capacity. So the QEG data ends up being quite validating because it lines up. And it's not even, you know, as straightforward as you might expect. For example, perhaps you're seeing those elevated slow wave patterns. I mean, yes, in the emotion regulation areas, but perhaps it's actually more in areas to do with sensory processing and more towards posterior regions of the head. Now we're talking about something related but different, which is perhaps somebody that's feeling very overwhelmed because of the disrupted sensory processing. And so then it just feels like too much at once. And therein lies the emotional ability. It becomes too much. And they shut down. They perhaps react instead of respond in ways that they otherwise wouldn't. So being able to walk through this with people, especially in the context of concussion, it ends up being quite validating and helps them see it. And then I also think really informs their ability to, let's say, follow that relative rest protocol. So whether or not you're doing neurofeedback or, you know, some type of neurotherapy, even just incorporating the QEG like that goes a long way. It's almost as if the QEG review itself is its own form of neurofeedback.
Well, we often talk about how QEGs are so validating, and they really, I'm sure everyone who's done this has had this experience where you go through the report with an individual, and it's this huge sense of relief that somebody finally gets them. And particularly for something like concussion that really doesn't show up on MRI or CAT scan, but you can find signs consistent with it in EEG and sort of the interpretation of that. And another piece that I think is important to highlight that you were talking about is that you can have the same symptom relating to dysregulation in different parts of the brain. Mm-hmm. And the EEG can help us find that where a lot of the checklist types of approaches can't. So again, you've been doing this for a long time, and you know, this sort of integrating EEG into something like the Excellent Brain System, it occurred to me actually as we were talking that you and I started off this conversation with the assumption that this is a good thing and everyone should be doing it, but that's actually a relatively new idea. I mean, I can remember starting in this work, and I'm sure the same is true with you, where there was no concussion protocol, where it's like you hit your head and you sort of, you know, slap on the back, get back in the field kind of thing. And while that's sort of changing, it's still an issue. So I'm just kind of curious what you think, how you think this may help kind of develop that system of concussive protocol of brain health. How can a system like Excellent Brain or EEGs help do that?
The phrase that comes to mind is informed consent. When we do these different activities, sports, or even just recreational activities, I mean, it's worth really thinking about what we're signing up for. And, you know, sport, you know, is wonderful. Like, who needs reality TV, right? You can find it often in a, you know, Cinderella story in some, you know, sports arena. But with that comes the risk of injury, of course, like most things, even just driving your car. And so really recognizing, you know, what are we signing up for when we go to play whatever the sport might be, whether it's us or our children or, you know, our future self that we think about for our own self. I think from the informed consent perspective, it's just really worth asking the hard question of through these both, you know, direct and indirect assessments, you know, what's at stake here? What are we actually influencing? Do we want to keep playing if we have a bad enough injury or a series of bad enough injuries? So I think that that brain health perspective and in our informed consent, it really comes to mind. And from the autonomy, you know, ethically, the autonomy perspective, and really respecting the ability of somebody to make their own decision. But again, just with that informed consent mentality.
And this can add the data, can add information necessary to make an informed decision.
Yeah. 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 Otherwise, you know, we can miss it. People then, you know, even going through it, you know, it's easy to miss. You know? And even, you know, one, there's the neurological condition anosognosia, which is the impairment itself impairing the ability to assess the impairment. Mm-hmm. And there you have, you know, the person with cognitive decline through something as, you know, heartbreaking as Alzheimer's or some type of dementia. And the very decline, the dementia, let's say, is impairing the ability of the person to assess that they are missing their bills, that they are missing deadlines, things like that. And so too with concussion, we can have in this sphere, the impairment itself getting in the way of our own ability to assess how we're actually doing. And so these other measures help us see it for ourselves, but then also even, let's say, meet our own self where we're at. And what I mean by that is there are plenty of conversations I've had with people where usually when somebody's going through post-concussive syndrome, they're describing a series of good days and bad days, as in many other contexts as well. And on the good days, when they're feeling quite good, they do a lot. And on the bad days where they're not feeling well, maybe they're not doing a lot. And there's a challenge there. As someone goes through those bad days, when the good day comes, they want to do a lot and often too much, and they overdo it, and then they're paying for it. And there's a cycle there where then they have the good day, overdo it, and there afterwards are the series of bad days as they recover from overdoing it. So even just using something like a symptom checklist plus a QEEG to remind our own self, like, hey, there is this impairment. It's actually in your brain. It's not just in your head. It's actually in your head. Plus these cognitive and symptom measures that are helping visualize it and really make it tangible. Because otherwise, you know, again, anosognosia, perhaps we're not even realizing how much it's truly affecting us.
Well, I really like the idea of standardizing. And so having something like this Excellent Brain and of course QEEG is standardizing against a database, a normative database. And on the other side of that, what you started off our conversation with, which is if you've seen one concussion, you've seen one concussion. So how do we balance this sort of high variability in presentation with trying to come up with reliable and valid measures? Mm.
That's a good question. Because as each one is so different and each person is so different, I like that word, neurodivergence, right? If we are neurodivergent, let's say at baseline, we are then going to be neurodivergent at injury and then through recovery as well. So, you know, I think for one, you mentioned those normative databases and even the in Excellent Brain, that, especially the cognitive measures, that's normed as well. So if the normative database is there, whether it's for a QEEG measure or a cognitive measure, it's a meaningful reference point, but perhaps it's not the expectation. So as we have somebody who is, let's say, taking the cognitive test at baseline, they're going to come out with their profile, let's say, and they'll have their relative strengths and relative weaknesses. After injury, that will likely be exaggerated. And let's say the relative weaknesses become even harder and let's say more weaker, and the relative strengths become even harder to come by. And all of this under tax as the, you know, metabolic and energy crisis that is concussion is at work. And so as somebody is then taking their post-injury testing, you're going to see worse scores, and you might see a similar profile in those strengths and weaknesses, but, you know, likely exaggerated. And so too in the QEEG, you know, maybe at baseline or even after recovery, there are those statistically atypical findings in the brainwave measures. And yet you can have statistically atypical findings in somebody that's just doing a QEEG because they're curious. You know, so just because there's that data showing up in a profile that suggests a weakness, it doesn't automatically mean it's a weakness. You know, maybe it's actually a strength or a compensatory mechanism. So allowing that natural variability, allowing that, let's say, that space for clinical correlation that is not necessarily causation, not holding onto it too tightly, and yet at the same time allowing that conversation for strengths and weaknesses that are being influenced by this injury, but we also hold on to it as we go through recovery.
So we sort of have to, like you're saying, hold on to both our standardizations, but recognize the variability. It's when you go to the relative side of the things in the QEEG, I suspect.
Yeah.
Well, so if a clinician finds himself with a client who had a concussion or wants to get into this work, is there one piece of advice you would give them to get started?
I'd probably say,
besides gets lots of mentoring and supervision.
Yeah. Besides that, I mean, I think from the EEG perspective, from the QEG perspective, I mean, I think it's important to just do that for one, to that clinician. But then even in terms of that, holding on the right amount of loosely, you know, a lot of the research is pointing you towards increases in slower frequencies like delta and theta. That's often the case, but there's other ways that, let's say, that low cortical arousal can appear. You know, perhaps it is not always that elevation of slower frequencies. Maybe it's a deficiency of fast. You know, so maybe there's insufficient beta. Maybe there's, you know, dysregulations in the alpha. So maybe there's a change in the posterior dominant rhythm. Maybe it's not as well defined as it, you know, maybe it's slowed. I've seen that. I've, you know, some of these cases, you know, I've been able to plot in one individual the posterior dominant rhythm over the course of time, you know, at baseline, after injury and after recovery, and it almost ends up as a sort of U, where it was, you know, at whatever speed at baseline, it slowed down through the injury and recovery phase. And then by clearance from the concussion, it had increased back towards baseline. So there's a lot of different measures, and a lot of different ways that, you know, that it can show up. And so I just think it's important to look at it and consider it, you know, in reference to the individual. Holding on to the research, it typically is those slow wave patterns that are showing it, or that it is showing up through. There's a lot of different ways that it can actually appear. So I just think it's worthwhile to look and pay attention, and then meet the individual where they're at. You know, looking at the regions of the brain that are lining up with the symptoms that you're seeing on the symptom checklist, the cognitive performance on the cognitive test, and looking through that overlap. That's a lot to throw at a clinician that's just saying, oh, how do I get my head around this? I think it's worth trying. I think that's what I think it is. I think it's I think that that clinician ought to be applauded for even, you know, letting themselves consider what may seem unusual or unorthodox to even start weaving the electrophysiology in. Because like you said, it's typically not showing up on the CT scan or the MRI. Thank goodness, because if it is, there's a much larger issue at play. But because it's not there, because there's not the skull fracture that shows up, then is it, you know, too quickly dismissed and said, you know, you'll be back to baseline, give it, you know, 14, 21 days, and then you should be good. And yet the rest of the school year is a challenge because we're getting migraine headaches every day that we're in the intense fluorescent lighting that often goes with the school environment. So I just think it's worth looking at, especially the QEG data, and then meeting the individual where they're at.
Well, David, this has been really helpful. I mean, this is such a complex issue, the more tools, I think we have more valid tools we have to really understand what's going on and to be able to track, the better off we are. So really appreciate both the webinar, and thank you again for joining us here on Healthy Brain, Happy Body.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us on Healthy Brain, Happy Body. Subscribe to this podcast by clicking the subscribe here link in the show notes or wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoy Healthy Brain, Happy Body, please rate us and leave reviews at Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you get the podcast. Reviews help us reach more listeners, and that's more people who can learn about and benefit from biofeedback, neurofeedback, and other mind-body approaches to health. Also, let us know what you think by sending us email. Our address is healthybrain@nrps.org. Healthy Brain, Happy Body is produced and edited by me. The theme music is Catch It by Coma Media. It is a production of the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society. Go to nrbs.org to find out more about the organization, including our trainings, monthly webinars, and yearly conference. All opinions expressed are those of our guests and not the NRBS. This podcast is not meant to replace advice from qualified healthcare providers. Healthy Brain, Happy Body is supported by the sponsors of NRBS. Be sure to join us on our next episode as we continue to explore the keys to our well-being on Healthy Brain, Happy Body.